are about to start with the third of three sessions that are designed to get at the third desired outcome. Identify the most important criteria used by existing watershed-based planning tools / resources to analyze priorities and restoration options.
I needed the table.
And recall there were three questions that
I didn't have the table last time.
So they'll be addressing those.
No one is sitting here.
And the facilitated discussion that we have following this presentation is going to be focused on decision support tools. So this is the original proposal we came up with, and I just was talking to the Matt Ford group, and I think she's gone. essentially, now what we're planning on doing is maybe someone can just cast that real quick. So this is get you thinking while you're looking at these presentations. Again, this is the third panel. So after this third panel is done, you will have heard from six separate speakers, all of whom have talked about criteria and pretty much all touched upon different decision support tools that are out there to analyze restoration options and opportunities. So what we'd like to do after that, very short Q&A hopefully, just to make sure that we're on the same page, spend a short amount of time, hopefully 5 minutes, not much more, on defining decision support tools, just so we're sure we're on the same page, what we mean when we say that. Then discuss just different categories of decision support tools so that we can lump them for the numbers to make the next conversation a little bit easier. And then have a conversation a little bit about what these different categories of tools are particularly good at doing, and which are quick, cheap, and easy, and which are difficult and expensive. See here kind of talks about that a lot more. What categories of tools require minimal information that is easy and inexpensive to acquire, and which categories require information that is more difficult and expensive to acquire. So hopefully we'll define them, we'll lump them, and then we'll kind of look at them from the standpoint of a district which has minimal staff, budget, and expertise and technical expertise in doing this kind of thing. What tools are most appropriate in that situation versus places where there's extensive information and capacity. That's our hope. Three speakers we have up now, Steve Ashby, Bill Easley, and Melissa Olsen-Callahan. Steve Ashby has 26 years of experience as a physical scientist and research hydrologist, and is currently the program manager of the System-Wide Modeling, Assessment, and Restoration Technologies, or SMART, Research and Development Program. His recent research includes designing and conducting water quality and ecosystem restoration studies in freshwater and coastal ecosystems. Bill Ainslie came to EPA Region 4 Wetlands Program in 1989. He served as a project manager for the Clean Water Act 404 permitting and enforcement for the states of Kentucky and Georgia until 1995. And he is currently the mitigation coordinator for EPA Region 4 and is developing wetland assessment tools for use at multiple spatial scales. Melissa Olsen-Callahan is a hydrologist with Perot Systems Government Services and is on contract to the NOAA Coastal Services Center in Charleston, South Carolina. Her recent work includes landscape characterization projects in northern Puget Sound and Lake St. Clair and the development of a riparian landscape assessment method in Southern California. I think she's going to be talking to us about a few of those tools.
Interesting.
Okay, take the run.
I thought I could bring in some Coke or some coffee or something and just, but it happened. So as not to waste my precious time and hopefully get done early, I'll launch right in. Region 4, about 5 years ago in 1999, approached our EPA Corvallis lab about doing a regional prioritization because questions started coming up about, well, where should we work? And we're in a big region. We have lots of watersheds and things. So even though we weren't thinking necessarily in the terms that we've been thinking about the last couple of days, we went out, talked to Scott. Scott said, well, what you really need to do is a regional prioritization. And we went, okay. So anyway, he helped us. Now, the reason to put Scott on the authorship is because I plagiarized much of this slide presentation from one he gave in New Orleans. And secondly, if you have any real in-depth questions about what Synoptic is and where it comes from, talk to Scott. Okay, I'll do the best I can, but I too am slow. Okay, so what do I want to try to do? I want to try to introduce Synoptic, what it is, how it works, why use it, what it's good for. Then in the context of something we've done in the Southeast, we've done a regional prioritization based on a sediment reduction assessment, and I'll talk about what that is. I specifically talk about the prioritization criterion, and we have one. Can landscape scale information be used in mitigation decision making? I don't know. Maybe. If it's useful, use it. Okay. So what is it? The Synoptic approach is designed for geographic prioritization, and it's designed for that prioritization given limited resources and information. So right from the get-go, it's recognized that we can't go everywhere and do everything, that there's limited time, there's limited man hours, and there's limited money. The prioritization criterion are essentially lined out in a publication which Jeff Hyman and Scott Leibowitz wrote, based on either restoration or protection. Okay, those are ecological endpoints. We'll talk about those a little bit more. Effort limitations, time, money, and labor. Often the data and the knowledge to cover large areas is limited, so we have to take that into account. And ultimately, as we're no different than Molly is, we like to see pictures. We're very graphically oriented, so the outputs come out as a map. And so at the end of the presentation, I'll show you the map. It's cool. Okay. The use of the Synoptic approach is appropriate when quantitative accurate information is not available. So as Dan showed with those different scale models of different assessments at different scales, this is really designed to be at a regional scale. And so we don't have a lot of quantitative accurate information at that large scale. Now if the information can go down to smaller scales, and I'll explain that a little later, then you can continue to do synoptic assessments or synoptic comparisons between watersheds. Okay, is the cost of obtaining or improving information is high? If that's the case, then synoptic may be appropriate. Cost of a wrong answer is low. In other words, if you choose to work over here versus over here, it doesn't really matter. You're still using the prioritization to help guide decisions. There's a high demand for the information. I think by virtue of this workshop and our desire to get at where do we put our resources in the region, there's a high demand for the information. Okay? And then prioritizing multiple decisions. Synoptic will prioritize based on a number of watersheds as opposed to inputting watershed information into a permit decision. So we're not trying to optimize a particular decision. We're just saying we've got a lot of places to work. How do we sort through that information? Okay. Leibowitz and Hyman, 1999. That's actually the wrong date. It should be 2000. But the goal of a synoptic prioritization is to maximize ecological benefit. Ecological benefit can take the form of either protection or restoration gained from limited resources. It's essentially a cost-benefit or a benefit-cost approach. The benefit is in terms of an ecological endpoint. We want to protect wetlands or we want to restore wetlands. And the cost is typically in terms of effort. And typically, in the synoptics that have been done across the country, the three or four, effort takes the form of either FTEs, the amount of staff time, or dollars. The prioritization criterion, which is used in a synoptic, is the marginal change in ecological function per management effort. The criterion is change in function, not total function. So we're not trying to measure total function. We're just trying to say if you expend a certain amount of effort in a particular location, will you get change? And that change can either be an avoided risk from protection or increase in function from restoration. Is it quasi-clear? Sort of clear? Okay. Let's, this is one of Scott's slides. Let's see if it works. Great. Okay. So in this situation, we've got our ecological endpoint, which is our benefit, on the y-axis, and management effort on the x-axis. If you expend a certain amount of effort, and we assume a linear relationship between the ecological endpoint and the amount of effort, you will get a change in the ecological endpoint. In this particular case with protection, you assume that the protected is the current state of the wetland. If you don't expend effort, it will be unprotected and it will be degraded. So in this case, it's actually avoided degradation, which is the endpoint. Kind of a logic glitch, and you got to read the paper about six times before you really get it. But anyway, and so in ranking different sites amongst each other, you're basically comparing slopes of lines. So in other words, this would be two watersheds. We're comparing the two watersheds with a protection criterion. Our ecological endpoint is protection. The slope of the green line is greater than the slope of the red line. That's how the prioritization ranks the watersheds. And so the watershed, the green watershed, ranks higher than the red watershed, meaning that you can get more protection for the same amount of effort in the green watershed than you can in the red watershed. Some larger site. It's a watershed. So it tends to be kind of an average condition. As how it actually boils down in the data. Okay. So green versus red. Okay. All right. Limited information. Okay. If possible, we would love to be able to go out and use detailed data which draws that linear relationship and directly correlates to it. However, oftentimes, and I would submit practically all the time, we don't have that luxury. At least we don't have that luxury. So we use judgment indicators. And Scott and Jeff wrote another paper on the use of scale invariance in evaluating judgment indicators and basically established a basis for saying, okay, you can use judgment indicators. It's all right. As long as you're using them for relative rankings. Okay, so as I move on, what you'll find is that we've used a lot of judgment indicators. Okay, one of the precepts of the synoptic is that you come up with a conceptual model, and the reason we come up with a conceptual model is that it basically lays out our understanding of relevant ecological processes. So we have to take into account what are the ecological processes which affect our ecological endpoint, and that formalizes our understanding. And by formalizing our understanding, then we can pick those indicators and those variables which are pertinent to what we're trying to get at, to our ecological endpoint and our level of effort. And so, in other words, we're not just layering data on top of one another and saying, gee, you know, this is a cool layer and this is a cool layer, and I'll bet you if I look at this layer and it comes up chartreuse, that'll be meaningful. We have something a little more logical and rational to guide our decision-making and how we choose the indicators that we do. But the model's not developed for simulation or hypothesis testing or direct analysis. It's just to guide our selection. Okay, here's the big caveat. You know, it's almost like saying, well, we did all this stuff, but never mind. But it's not quite that, but it's almost like that. Anyway, you can't look at the results of the synoptic and say, these are real scientific findings. But it's guided by scientific principles. And we've been there before, and for those of you who have been involved with any assessment methodology and development of any assessment methodology, this comes to the fore a lot. Okay, so In Region 4 is comprised of the 8 southeastern states, Kentucky, Tennessee, the Carolinas, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, and Mississippi. Okay, we have 319 18-digit HUCs in Region 4. Those 8-digit HUCs are approximately 1,300 square miles big on average. So, big area. We have one office in Atlanta, and we try to cover all 8 states. So, in coming up with a synoptic prioritization criterion, we start asking, well, what's important to us in Region 4? And at the time we were asking that question, the TMDL lawsuits were flying in. I don't know whether any of you are y'all familiar with TMDLs and the lawsuits and all that kind of stuff? All right. Okay. Well, that was a big deal, and we thought that perhaps by focusing on water quality impairment and the role wetland restoration might play in ameliorating water quality impairment, that we could create a product that was not only good for the wetlands program, but also good for the TMDL program and some of the other programs. So, just by way of some background, sediment is number one non-point source pollutant in the United States and third most prevalent source of stream impairment for streams on the 303D list in the southeast. Since wetlands have a demonstrated ability to retain sediments, we decided, hey, that's a pretty good match. And there are lots of areas to restore, so let's restore areas where they can ameliorate sediment, help water quality, hence my comment this morning. So our goals were to maximize wetland restoration to ameliorate sediment in streams. This has been said before. This is explicit. In Synoptic, we wanted to get the biggest bang for the buck. We wanted to go to places where we could restore the most wetland for the least amount of money and get to our ecological endpoint of ameliorating sediment yield. Prioritize restoration efforts for the 404 program, which includes mitigation banking, TMDL implementation. We currently have a watershed program. Wow, time flies. And the non-point source program. Okay? And also, if anybody happened to ask us, how did you pick that particular watershed, we could tell them. And we want to continue. Okay. All right. So our assessment objective, if some level of funding were available for restoring headwater wetlands, where should restoration be targeted so as to provide the optimal reduction of sediment yield? That's what we were trying to do. Here is our criterion, wherever that question is. This is it. That's our prioritization criterion. The marginal change in total downstream sediment yield per restoration dollar. Okay? We can't measure that directly, so we have to break that down into a series of concepts, and then those concepts are further broken down into variables. And then we get to the indicators or the data we use. Okay, the three key concepts is we want to increase wetland restoration per dollar. We want to decrease the hydrologic response or the vector which carries the sediment into the streams. And we want to decrease the amount of sediment delivered. Okay, so we have three basic concepts. The first one, wetland restoration, is composed of three essentially variables: restorability index, place-based index, and a property index. Restorability gets to, are there locations where wetland restoration would be more sustainable than in other places? Does it have hydric soils? Is it near other wetlands? And are there urban or ag areas around it? If there are, then that might be a good place to put it. Place-based index is watershed and wetland protection groups and protected areas. That means, are you putting the wetland in an area where people want wetlands to be put, and therefore they would contribute to this sort of the public participation and the buy-in coordination stuff? And then the property index, how cheap's the land? Okay, so here's our flow chart. You'll see this several times. Marginal change in total downstream sediment yield per restoration dollar is the ultimate criterion. That's broken down into three sub-criterion, perhaps. Marginal change in restored wetland per restoration dollar, change in hydrologic response, and change in sediment yield. Please pay attention to the green areas. The three variables are restorability, community willingness, and purchasing efficiency. Here are the actual indicators. Is it laser? Laser. Hydric soils, wetland density in developed areas. What data did we use? We went to very easily accessible data layers, StatsGo and National Land Cover Dataset. Okay, everybody can get that stuff. Okay, watershed protection groups, community willingness. That was a tough one to get a handle on. We went to watershed protection groups. How many are there, and are there protected lands in a particular watershed? TVA had done a census of the southeast to find out where the watershed protection groups were and who they were and all this other kind of stuff. Dubious data, however data nevertheless. And the federal lands is a coverage. Okay, and then property value. USDA census had property values. We used the reciprocal of that in the interest. Storm flow index, this gets at how much rain is there to carry the sediment into the water. Have a runoff delivery index, entails looking at hydrologic response, proportion of urban land use and stream density, and precipitation. And then is there any land out there that can actually intercept the flow of water? So once again, here we are, storm flow and interception. Storm flow is broken down into yield, runoff delivery. Here are the actual indicators that we used, and here are the data layers. Hewlett refers to a paper that was written which estimated the hydrologic response across the southeast. But once again, very common data layers. PRISM climate model you can get off the shelf, National Land Cover Dataset, and the National Hydrography Dataset to get its stream density. Okay, and then sedimentation potential for watershed, erodibility, density of unpaved roads, proportion of agriculture, and how erosive is the soil. That, once again, comes from the erodibility comes from the universal soil loss equation, the K factor, which is in the StatsGo database. Russell comes from, or the R factor, erosivity, also comes from the same place. Tiger files and National Land Cover data set. So this isn't data that required a lot of acquisition. It's widely available. And the other thing we had to consider in looking at data was it consistent across the region? We couldn't use any data set that was good for North Carolina but didn't exist for Florida. So we had to use stuff that was ubiquitous. Okay, so the synopsis of the synoptic is this is the equation which basically gets us at our criterion, our prioritization criterion, is the change in sediment yield due to wetland restoration is dependent upon the wetland restoration being cost-effective, attenuating the hydrologic response, and intercepting sediment. And then there was a headwater weighting factor put in there because of things that I don't have time to go into. We chose to focus on headwater wetlands as opposed to all wetlands and main stem wetlands. Okay, and Molly, here's the map. Okay, blue is very high priority. Orange is very low priority. Okay, and we could go back, we can track back through this and tell you why Florida is a fairly low priority, probably because it's flat, it's got very permeable soils, and it's all covered up with concrete anyway. just kidding. So anyway, once again, this is when the synoptic is appropriate, is when you don't have a lot of information, and the information that you need just kind of gets you into a general area, then it's useful. As far as application issues, scale of the assessment is very large. It's a regional scale. It's an 8-digit HUC scale. You land in an 8-digit HUC. It's 1,300 square miles big. You still have the question of, so now what? What do I do? And that's when I think you can start to step down and use some of these other techniques that we've been talking about. Transfer into commercial banking, would it be useful in the 404 program? Perhaps. In banking sorts of situations, perhaps the agencies, if they agree that this is a reasonable prioritization, could give incentives to bankers like early credit releases and stuff like that, too. Because we don't cite banks. We don't tell bankers where to put banks. They tell us where they want to put a bank, and then we decide whether we like it or not. So if you want to try to entice them into a particular watershed, you might have to provide incentives for that. How that actually works out, I don't know. Relation to on-site in-kind. If you've got a high-priority watershed that you want to put restoration in, what does that do to your on-site stuff? It may send you off to another watershed and provide justification for going off-site in a watershed context, and you may that would bump up against G, on-site in kind. So I'm just raising that. There's only one function that we looked at in Synoptic, and different agencies have different priorities. So basically, oh, you can't see any of the banks. How about that? Okay, so I'll just blow by that. We also did the Synoptic by state. So rather than look at all 319 HUCs, we also broke each down by state and prioritized watersheds within each state. So that may be more useful in a programmatic context than the entire region. Okay, I'm done.